Scorpio. 106 FM.
Wel nog altijd zwaar gedeconstrueerde R&B Changes van Klein. Changes van Klein, benieuwd wat zij dit jaar nog allemaal gaat uitbrengen. Jaylin die deelde via haar Facebook een hele map met oude nummers die ze ongeveer 10 jaar geleden heeft gemaakt. Zelf zegt ze erover, I can definitely hear the growth over the years. Dit is Jaylin, we gaan er trouwens 2 van draaien, maar we beginnen met Temptation.
Listen to the sound.
I think.
Temptation van Jaylin van op Facebook eigenlijk. Uit diezelfde map, een volgend nummer 808. Nog eens, Jaylin.
You are entering the seventh dimension. seventh dimension.
Van Jaylin, ja, had zo gepast op haar debuutalbum Dark Energy. Het zit er bijna op voor ons. Zo dadelijk is het Club 106. We hebben er nog eentje voor jullie klaar. We reizen nog één keer de wereld rond. En we houden halt in Dar es Salaam met producer Jay Mitto. Die maakt Sigeli. Sigeli, dat is razendsnelle elektronische dansmuziek uit Tanzania. Melodisch pakken ze eigenlijk stukken, de instrumentale stukken eigenlijk, tarabmuziek, maar dan geloopt en fameus versneld. Het zit ongeveer, dacht ik, rond de 300 beats per minuut. Komt dat op Niege Tapes van op Tatizo Pesa is dit Macera van Jay Mitto. Tot volgende week.
On a bayou down Louisiana way? Have you watched the cold fog drifting over San Francisco Bay? Have you heard a Bob White calling in the Carolina Pines? Or heard the bellow of a diesel at the Appalachia Mines? Does the call of the Niagara thrill you when you hear her waters roar? You look with awe and wonder at her Massachusetts shore where men who braved a hard new world first stepped on Plymouth Rock. Do you think of them when you stroll along a New York City dock? Have you seen a snowflake drifting in the Rockies way up high? Have you seen the sun come blazing down from a bright Nevada sky? Do you hail to the Columbia as she rushes into the sea, or how you're headed Gettysburg? Our struggle to be free? Have you seen the mighty Tetons? You watched an eagle soar? Have you seen the Mississippi roll along Missouri's shore? Have you felt a chill at Michigan when on a winter's day her waters rage along the shore in thunderous display? Does the word aloha make you warm? Do you stare in disbelief when you see the surf come roaring in at Waimea Reef? From Alaska's cold to the Everglades, from the Rio Grande to Maine, my heart cries out, my pulse runs fast, the might of her domain. You ask me why I love her? I've a million reasons why. My beautiful America, beneath God's wide, wide sky.
The Ex-Worker.
An audio strike against a monotone world.
A twice monthly podcast of anarchist ideas and action.
For everyone who dreams of a life off the clock.
Hey everyone, welcome back to The Ex-Worker. In this episode, we'll be taking on one of the major social and political crises in the news over the past year. The Syrian civil war and other political and economic conflicts around the world have precipitated a significant flow of migrants and refugees from Asia and Africa into Europe. Correspondingly, the European countries where they're passing through and arriving to have experienced significant social and political conflicts around how to respond. The Islamic State terror attacks in France have raised the stakes, as rumors circulate about the potential that one or more of the attackers may have entered France as a refugee, and right-wing nationalists across Europe use the event to mobilize against migrants and anti-fascists.
In this episode, we'll take a look at Europe's so-called refugee crisis from an anarchist perspective. To do that, we'll first pan back to look at what anarchists have to say about borders and migration, before focusing in on patterns of global migration today. Since there are a pretty wide range of perspectives and issues to cover, we're going to approach this episode kind of like a mixtape, pasting together bits from a variety of different interviews and even past episodes to offer an impressionistic look at how and why people move across the world and the barriers thrown up by states to impede and control them.
We'll also share an update on the anti-anarchist repression in Spain, a report back from the Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild action camp, and an announcement for a new prisoner publication, as well as plenty of news, upcoming events, and more. My name is Alanis.
And I'm Clara, and we'll be your hosts. As per usual, you can find a full transcript of this episode, along with plenty of links and references to learn more, at crimethink.com/podcast. And we're always eager to hear from you. Drop us a line by email to podcast@crimethink.com to share your thoughts about this episode.
Let's get moving.
Let's kick things off with the hot wire, our look at resistance and revolt happening around the world. Alanis?
The El Paso 54, a group of asylum seekers from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and Pakistan currently detained in Texas, staged a week-long hunger strike in protest against their detention, which inspired a group of 14 Indian and Bangladeshi detainees in Jenna, Louisiana, to also go on strike.
Multiple other prisoners in the U.S. have undertaken hunger strike campaigns lately. Keith Lamar, an inmate on Ohio's death row for his participation in the infamous 1993 Lucasville uprising, successfully struck to be able to keep his collections of books and CDs during his last few months on Earth. Amazon, a transgender prisoner in California and a member of the Gender Anarchy Collective, has been on hunger strike since October 7th, demanding a transfer to a women's facility. More information about how to show solidarity with these and other prisoners is in the notes for today's show.
A group of Normalistas, radical students from the same school attended by the 43 young people kidnapped by Mexican police last year, were violently attacked by state and federal police. Police shot tear gas and broke the windows of the buses the students and teachers were riding in, and beat them as they fled, arresting at least 13 and injuring at least 8. While also brutalizing journalists who attempted to film the attack. The cops claim they attacked because the students had stolen fuel from a truck full of gasoline. One of the students said that the cops were just trying to intimidate them before a big march scheduled for later that week.
In Montreal, Indigenous militants and their supporters protested and blockaded the Mercier Bridge in an attempt to stop the dumping of billions of liters of raw sewage into the St. Lawrence River. Blocking the bridge is an especially poignant gesture, given that it is the same bridge that was occupied by Mohawks for 2 days during the Oka crisis in 1990, another important milestone in Indigenous resistance in so-called Canada.
Members of a far-right militia in Greece planted an explosive device outside the Epavli Kouvelou squat in a northern suburb of Athens, Greece. The explosion caused heavy damage to some nearby houses and shops, and minor damage to the main entrance of the squat itself. The Squat has previously been targeted by right-wing attackers, including the Golden Dawn in 2014, in response to interventions undertaken by residents of the Squat, including solidarity initiatives with migrants, resistance to the government, and anti-fascist activities. 300 or so comrades participated in a demonstration in support of the Squat.
More bad news from Greece. 27 people have been officially indicted in relation to an attempted prison break by members of Conspiracy Cells of Fire, an anarcho-individualist group which has undertaken dozens of fiery attacks against capitalist targets since 2008. Among the indicted are the mother of two of the imprisoned, as well as Evi Statiri, whose hunger strike to secure her release from prison we reported on in our last episode.
Arsonists burned the office and vehicles of a corporation in charge of a hydroelectric dam on indigenous Pehuenche territory in Chile, leaving only an anti-capitalist communique behind.
In the small Balkan nation of Montenegro, thousands of protesters demanding the resignation of the prime minister clashed outside the parliament building with riot police, who attacked with tear gas and managed to disperse the encampment of protesters that has occupied the area for weeks.
Migrants rioted at a detention camp for asylum seekers on an island off the coast of Australia after the death of an Iranian Kurdish refugee who had recently escaped. The Department of Immigration issued a statement claiming that the operation to regain control of the center and ensure the welfare of those not participating in criminal damage activities was achieved largely through negotiation and cooperation with detainees. Though, they admitted, some force was used with a core group of detainees who had built barricades and actively resisted attempts to secure compounds, including threatened use of weapons.
This is just the latest incident in a truly horrifying situation for migrants attempting to enter Australia. The week before, according to Al Jazeera, human teeth were found in a meal served to an asylum seeker in the Manus Island Detention Center, just a few days after almost 100 asylum seekers reportedly suffered food poisoning. While in this episode we'll focus on the situation of migrants entering Europe in particular, it's important to remember that these patterns of displacement and migration, and the misery caused by the system of national borders, stretches across the globe.
In Minneapolis, police shot and killed Jamar Clark, an unarmed black man, and have refused to release video footage of the murder. Rounds of increasingly angry protests have taken place, including a highway shutdown resulting in 50 arrests, and an around-the-clock Black Lives Matter encampment outside the nearest police station. As we go into production, the number of people killed by police in the U.S. in 2015 has reached at least 1,066 and continues to rise every day.
In other U.S. repression news, a Freedom of Information Act request by Vice News revealed the existence of a secret agreement between the FBI and the Washington, D.C. Metro Police Department regarding the use of the Stingray, a small mobile device that law enforcement agencies can use to intercept cell phone calls and text messages. According to a non-disclosure agreement stipulated by the Florida-based company that manufactures the Stingray, local police departments can conceal evidence gathered using the device from lawyers and judges to preserve secrecy about how the device is used. According to the agreement, revealing information about how Stingrays are used, even when required by law, could render them, quote, essentially useless as a law enforcement tool.
WikiLeaks, want to lend us a hand here?
There's a mind-bending article explaining it on Vice News, which we've posted a link to on our website.
Major anti-government demonstrations have been taking place in Seoul, South Korea in recent weeks. We received this account from a South Korean anarchist about the recent events.
On November 14th, around 100,000 people took to the streets of Seoul. This event has been called a general or people's demonstration, as the issues raised are multiple and express a rejection of the current government. To name just a few, the labor market reforms, the dire situation of farmers and unemployed youth, poverty, the government's ineffective and deceptive response to a major ferry accident, and their self-serving rewriting of history by directly imposing a new history textbook in public schools. This demonstration was the largest in 7 years, when the streets of central Seoul in front of the royal and presidential palaces were occupied for several days in a new form of decentralized and festive street action. Since then, the government has redesigned part of the area and blocked it off during demonstrations. On the other hand, it seems that crowds at demonstrations have constantly been trying to regain that territory, with ensuing clashes on the police lines. The last years have seen an escalation and outwitting game on this precise front. The police line is now a row of hundreds of reinforced buses parked head to tail in three layers. People have developed a way to pull out the buses using ropes and the sheer strength of numbers. Lately, police have responded by fastening the buses together, using long poles to cut the people's rope, pouring oil on the buses to render them slippery, etc. From behind the buses, the police rely mostly on the use of powerful cannons using a mixture of water and irritants, and have nearly killed someone and injured several with it. As this repression itself has become a target of indignation, and the preparedness of some demonstrators to confront it becomes apparent, tensions are on the rise, as a following demonstration has been called for December 5th.
We'll keep you posted on developments in Korea in future episodes. For some historical background and political context for the demonstrations, check out our coverage back in episode 41.
Earlier this summer in our next week's news section, we announced an anarchist and anti-colonial action camp taking place in eastern Canada called Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild. Some organizers from the gathering have sent us a report back about what happened, which we're excited to share with all of you. We hope it's informative and can also serve as an inspiration for folks outside of major urban centers looking to connect both to the land where they live and to other radicals in struggle. Here's what they had to say.
Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild, 2015 report back. It's with enthusiasm that I report back from the second ever annual action camp Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild, held this past July on Algonquin territory north of Ottawa. There is definite momentum within the eco-anarchist milieu of so-called Eastern Canada, and as our project enters its third year, our ambition and capacity continue to grow. First, some context. The original name for RRR was Resist, Revolt, Rewild, a play on the slogan, Reduce, Reuse, Recycle. We toned it down because we're not there yet. If revolt is a fire, we're gathering kindling. The rebuild in Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild refers to the need in our bioregion to rebuild activist networks, because for those of us who come from Ottawa, it feels like we are starting from scratch. The aftermath of the G20 repression resulted in an overall depression of anarchist activity in so-called Ontario, and the movement is still on the mend. Also, action camps are not all common practice here. We organized RRR in the spirit of popularizing this tactic, and since RRR began, there have been two other action camps within our movement. This is a good start. We believe in the strength of informal, affinity-based organizing, and to create such groups, people have to know each other. Last year's RRR was 3 days long, this year's was a full week, though many people came only for the weekend portion of it. It was intimate at first, some 20 people on Monday, swelling to 70-some on the weekend, with folks coming and going. Workshops were held on direct action, women's self-defense, combat, decolonization, anti-oppression, radical parenting, permaculture, and more. The weather was beautiful, and there was a lot of swimming, hiking, and socializing. One of the areas which was highly praised was the community care team, headed up by feminist women determined to create a safe space for all participants. The community care team was RRR's best organized committee and deserved a lot of credit for their role in tending to the social harmony of the camp. One highlight was the decolonization workshop held around a fire. In it, a traditional Cree woman spoke passionately and at length about the trauma of colonization, extraction, residential schools, sexual violence, healing, the importance of women's wisdom, and so much more, traveling through a crescendo of pain to arrive at a transcendent message of love and a vision of another way of living, expressed most beautifully by the Cree concept of the circle way of being, in which all are equal and have a say. For whatever reason, Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild has been embraced more by Francophone radical communities than Anglophone ones. Eco-anarchism is definitely on the rise in so-called Quebec. Many folks who've been active in anti-austerity struggles are now turning toward land-based resistance. Drawing from a lineage of rebellion spanning decades, with the infrastructure, networks, and culture built up over that time, the Quebecois eco-anarchist movement is well positioned to grow, solidify, and become mighty. Although there is much to celebrate about the momentum generated by RRR, no significant campaign of direct action is yet attributable to this camp. On the other hand, one truly inspiring land project is, and a second will begin in the spring. Who can say what will grow from the seeds that we have planted? Next year, comrades of ours will hold the first anarchist action camp ever in so-called New Brunswick, so we are pleased to report that our ideas are indeed finding fertile soil. For those of you who live in the hinterlands of rebellion, where revolution seems like a pale and skeletal fantasy, given life only by the unwillingness of your spirit to cede the terrain of your imagination to the enemies of life, we most humbly implore you not to give up. It is within your ability to bring moments of beauty into being, even if the horizon obscures the shore you long to reach. Where hearts beat, there is hope. Where people gather together in the spirit of anarchy to find more authentic ways of relating to one another and the natural world, good will come of it, and from thence new avenues of possibility will arise. It is the task of the revolutionary to render the impossible possible, and living somewhere not blessed with a thriving counterculture is no excuse not to organize. Be patient, be steadfast, and may the force be with you. For the wild, R. Repression against anarchists by the Spanish state has continued to escalate in recent weeks. Another recent round of arrests in Madrid under the auspices of Operation Pandora in late October and early November have brought the total number of anarchists arrested on terrorism charges over the last year up to 68. Our friends over at the excellent anarchist radio show, The Final Straw, got in touch with an anarchist in Spain for an update about what's going on there. Here's an excerpt.
In December 16th of last year, about a dozen anarchists, mostly in Barcelona, but also a couple other small cities of Catalonia, as well as one person in Madrid, were arrested under the anti-terrorism law. So they're basically using the anti-terrorism apparatus that they developed for use primarily against the Basque independence movement and now bringing that to bear against the anarchists. Basically, in the last years, the last Basque armed organization has been disarmed and dismantled. And so the Spanish state, on the one hand, has a big need to continue using this apparatus to invent a new internal enemy. And on the other hand, the last years have seen a rise in various social conflicts, general strikes, protests, riots, resistance to evictions, both evictions of houses and evictions in social centers. And while anarchists are by no means a major force in the Spanish state on the cusp of revolution, they have played an influential role in many of these struggles. So, and for a lot of reasons, it made sense for the Spanish state to start using anti-terrorism laws against the anarchists, even though there haven't been people killed or injured by anarchists. What's being prosecuted in Operation Pandora specifically are sabotage actions, primarily smashings or burnings of banks and things of that nature. And more broadly, anarchist organization and anarchist coordination. There was an anarchist group, the GAC, Grupos Anarquistas Coordinados, that was a publicly announced group. It was a space for coordination, put out a book criticizing democracy. And the police in Spain, both the Catalan police and then also in other operations, the Policía Nacional, based in Madrid, and then the a high court based in Madrid, the Audiencia Nacional, have basically completely arbitrarily linked the GAC to the FI3, or the Informal Anarchist Federation, IRF, which is the only anarchist formation on any kind of international scale that the European Union has declared to be a terrorist organization. There is no link whatsoever between the GAC and the FI3. They're completely different concepts, even. The GAC was a publicly announced coordinating space for anarchists in the Spanish state. FI3 is maybe more similar to like the ELF in the sense that it's a label that anarchists who choose to will put on communiques for illegal actions. Yeah, there's absolutely no link, but the Spanish police, aided by the media, manufactured this figure of the GAC FI3, and manufactured this figure of anarchist terrorism, which is a complete absurdity. So that started actually before December 2014. There were some arrests prior to that, but that was really the first case in which it was revealed that they're systematically trying to manufacture the appearance of a terrorist anarchist organization. Operation Piñata happened a few months after the first phase of Operation Pandora, and in terms of the judicial body, it's the same high court in Madrid, but the police conducting that investigation are the Policía Nacional. And most of those arrests were centered in Madrid, whereas Operation Pandora arrests have been centered primarily in Barcelona. But then the Piñata operation also had involved arrests and raids in Valencia, in Barcelona, in Granada. So it's more extensive across the Spanish state. The accusations were essentially the same. In fact, one person was arrested in both of those operations. And in fact, to date, over the last 2 years, less than 3 years, there have been 68 anarchists arrested across the Spanish state under the anti-terrorism law. So it's more than just these two operations. On October 28th of this year, there was the second phase of Operation Pandora in Barcelona and Manresa, which is a small city an hour away from Barcelona. Another 9 people were arrested. There was also more house raids, more social centers raided. After 3 days being locked up when they were brought before the judge, 8 of those 9 were released pending trial. Most of them had to pay large bails, and they have to sign in at court every 2 weeks. One person from second phase of Operation Pandora is currently locked up, awaiting trial, and the same person actually has a trial in January. He's also accused of some damages in the general strike of March 2012. So they decided to give him preventive detention pending trial. And in that case, it's also clearly a vindictive measure because he is actually the lawyer of some of the people from the first phase of Operation Pandora. And that's a common pattern that we've seen, is that whoever acts in solidarity or writes letters to or visits in prison any people arrested in one wave of repression is very likely to be included in the second wave of repression. So they're trying to exhaust and isolate any form of support. And that brings me to the other two people who are currently in prison awaiting trial. That's Monica and Francisco. And they have been in prison for more than 2 years. Theirs was one of the very first cases of the anti-terror law being used against anarchists. They were arrested in November 2013. And actually the day of the Pandora II arrests, the court in Madrid decided that Monica and Francisco could be held another 2 years pending trial. Because according to Spanish law, 2 years is the maximum that someone can be held in prison pending trial, and only under the most extreme circumstances. But the anti-terrorism law allows the courts to extend that for another 2 years. So it's definitely no coincidence that the second phase of Operation Pandora was launched on the very day that Monica and Francisco were decreed another 2 years of preventive prison. That was also a day when protests were planned in the event that the courts came down with that decision, and that's what happened. So it serves to exhaust people who are trying to organize solidarity, to also distract from that other case and to make sure that Monica and Francisco are more isolated. And then in addition to that, just a few days after the second phase of Operation Pandora, there were another 5 arrests in Madrid. Another 5 anarchists accused of some of the same actions that so many other people have already been arrested for and accused of. And of those 5, 2 were decreed preventive detention and so are currently locked up. So that's currently 5 anarchists who are locked up awaiting trial, and dozens more who are awaiting trial.
To hear the complete interview, which goes into much more detail about the cases, the context, and their political significance, stay tuned to The Final Straw at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org.
You're listening to the The X Worker.
An audio strike
against a monotone world.
So, in this episode, we're going to be talking about
borders and migration.
Whew. To be honest, Clara, I feel a little daunted. This is such a huge topic. I mean, where do we even get started?
Well, this is a Crime Thing podcast, so I guess we could just look it up in the contradictionary.
Sure. That's as good a place to start as any. Let's see. Well, I don't see anything on migration, but here's one for border.
Didn't we actually read that back in episode 12?
Oh yeah, we did. Here's an excerpt from that.
Border. To create a community where people share no real connection or common interest, establish a boundary, and accuse outsiders of violating it. This accusation implies that before the violation, the rightfully included lived together in purity, tranquility, and belonging. There was no such thing as America before immigrants, for example, but you'd never know it listening to racists and nationalists. It is common sense that boundaries create transgressors, but one might as easily say that the invention of transgressors creates boundaries, which would be unthinkable without them.
And then, let's add a section from To Change Everything, the anarchist appeal that CrimeThink released in many different languages and formats earlier this year. Back in episode 35, we produced an audio zine version of it. Here's an excerpt from that that takes on the problem of borders.
The problem is
borders.
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 Borders. Borders.
If a foreign army invaded this land, cut down the trees, poisoned the rivers, and forced children to grow up pledging allegiance to them, who wouldn't take up arms against them? But when the local government does the same, patriots readily render their obedience, tax dollars, and children.
Borders don't protect us. They divide us, creating needless friction with the excluded while obscuring real differences among the included. Even the most democratic government is founded upon this division between participants and outsiders, legitimate and illegitimate. In ancient Athens, the famed birthplace of democracy, only a fraction of the men were included in the political process. The founding fathers of modern-day democracy owned slaves. Citizenship still imposes a barrier between included and excluded inside the U.S., stripping millions of undocumented residents of leverage over their lives.
The liberal ideal is to expand the lines of inclusion until all the world is integrated into one vast democratic project. But inequality is coded into the structure itself. At every level of this society, 1,000 tiny borders divide us into powerful and powerless. Security checkpoints, credit ratings, database passwords, price brackets. We need forms of belonging that are not predicated on exclusion, that do not centralize power and legitimacy, that do not quarantine empathy to gated communities.
So, what do these definitions tell us?
Well, they highlight that the purpose of borders is to artificially or superficially unite people inside them by dividing them from people outside them. So, in the case of nations, they emphasize how all Americans, or Hungarians, or Egyptians, or Brazilians, or whoever, supposedly share something in common that transcends our divisions along lines of class or race or various other lines of difference.
And that a shared national interest is supposed to trump all other interests, to be the number one thing that's more important than any other.
Which is a very convenient idea for the rulers of these nations, to ensure obedience and to keep people resigned to their exploitation. I think that's what it's talking about when it mentions creating needless friction with the excluded while obscuring real differences among the included.
And that's why, from the beginning, anarchism has been an internationalist struggle. seeing that our interests as free human beings transcend national borders.
But these definitions aren't just talking about national borders. They seem to be talking about a lot of artificial distinctions that divide people from each other.
Right. So partly that has to do with social categories, like divisions along lines of gender and sexuality, concepts of race, notions of ability, and a variety of other types of norms and social borders that we use to police each other.
Yeah, I think that's a key word. The notion of policing is built into the very idea of borders. Borders are a mechanism of authoritarian control, and they require police to administer them, whether formal deputized and armed police like the Border Patrol, or the informal kind of policing we do every day to keep each other in line, or that we do to ourselves, like that cop in our heads who tells us to obey, to submit, to keep in line, to not rock the boat or transgress against social norms. If border is the noun, then to police is the verb.
And in the case of a lot of these little mini borders built into our daily lives, tax brackets and credit ratings, grades and SAT scores, etc., the very structures that make up everyday life make that policing automatic and almost invisible. They're so woven into the fabric of our social and economic existence that we see them as natural.
Well, particularly if we're on the right side of them.
Right. I guess I mean more that we internalize the notion that they exist and should exist. So that if we're on the right side of them, it's because we deserve it. Whereas if we're on the wrong side, we just need to work harder. Whereas an anarchist understanding of borders starts from the assumption that they are not natural or inevitable, but created by people and our social institutions.
And also that they're created for a reason, specifically to preserve power relations along specific lines. So if we want to change everything, if we want to live in a different world, one of our first steps is to identify the borders that are dividing us and to figure out whose interests they serve. And if not our own, then work out how to get together and dismantle them.
Okay, so that's a decent start. But we're still nowhere near understanding an anarchist perspective on national borders and human migration.
Right. Well, we started off talking from the broadest possible level about borders as a concept. Let's see if we can hone in on national borders and see where that takes us.
Okay. Well, to talk about national borders, we need to talk about nations and nationalism. To get started on that, let's share another clip from a past episode. This time from episode 11 on fascism and anti-fascism. We were trying to understand what fascism is, and in this section, we spoke about why nationalism is a crucial part of fascism, and why that brings fascists inevitably into conflict with anarchists.
Another core principle is nationalism. The mass politics of fascism rest on shared myths of racial or historical identity. Politics based on these identities operate through scapegoating, attributing social problems not to structural oppression or the actions of states, but to the characteristics of people within social groups defined as outside the imagined community of the nation. The particular form of bigotry may vary, depending on what kinds of oppressive myths a particular nationalism dictates. Oftentimes, this hatred of the outsider forms the only basis of an increasingly flimsy sense of nationhood. The coming insurrection illustrates this in their discussion of the role of xenophobia in propping up French identity in an increasingly atomized society. We have arrived at a point of privation where the only way to feel French is to curse the immigrants and those who are more visibly foreign. In this country, the immigrants assume a curious position of sovereignty. If they weren't here, the French might stop existing. This turns on its head the typical fascist claim that immigrants threaten the racial existence of a nation, such as the frenzied fears of U.S. racists about demographic shifts that may result in a white minority. In fact, without blacks to blame for crime, Mexicans to blame for job losses, Jews to blame for the banking crisis, gays to blame for undermining the traditional family, and so on, we would actually have to look at capitalism, oppression, and state power to figure out why we have the problems we have today. And that's why another consistent feature of fascism is virulent opposition to communists, anarchists, and most other radicals. Many of the violent attacks by European fascists we mentioned earlier targeted political radicals. Fascist punk bands continue the Cold War with Rock Against Communism, linking opposition to radical politics with anti-Semitism and racism. Why such a focus on fighting radicals and leftists? Well, in large part because they've been the most prominent militant anti-fascists since the beginning. And allying with powerful conservative forces against radicals can bring leverage and legitimacy to the extreme right wing. But fundamentally, the reason for this opposition is because radicals also mobilize around discontent in society. But, rather than offering false racist explanations and oppressive solutions, look at the root causes and promote solidarity among all people towards a freer world. And this puts us in direct competition with fascists, who rely on duping people into channeling their legitimate rage into hatred for oppressed groups and support for hierarchical power.
So, what does this tell us?